Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to tonight's show of Taboo No More, a production of One World Communications in association with People to People. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Hoffman, and tonight we'll be discussing a very important topic of child abuse and violence against women. We have a very special guest tonight, Emmabet Kebede. She's a lawyer by profession. She's been pursuing her advanced degree. She just received a fellowship to get an advanced degree at Harvard University. She's up in Cambridge right now, and we're very happy to have her on this show. She's an expert in children's rights and women's rights in Ethiopia. So tonight we're going to talk about child abuse and violence against women. Welcome, Emmabet.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jeff. It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. So we know that you've done a lot of work in the areas of child abuse and women's rights in Ethiopia specifically, and like to focus primarily on child abuse, and then our callers may have some other questions related to this as well. We will have a little Q&A, the two of us, for the next 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the line for callers. And just to remind people, the call-in number is 646-595-4742. And you'll press number one and wait in the queue. Denise, our engineer, will set you up there. So, but we'll be talking for about 20 minutes, and we'll open up the line for calls. So, Emmabet, tell us, what would you say is the official meaning of child abuse, and how is child abuse different from punishment or discipline? How do you differentiate those things?
Well, I don't think there is a universally accepted definition for child abuse, but, you know, there are different definitions that have been given by different institutions. I would say, like, a CDC definition that I use a lot is quite good. It says, you know, it's an act or it's an omission child abuse, and it could be by a parent or by any other caregiver, but it results in harm and or has a potential of harming a child or causes a threat of harm to a child. The way I would say the difference between punishment and discipline is, first of all, in the intention for discipline, the intention is, you know, to be a teaching moment for a child. So what you do is to improve a child's behavior in the future, and it's not done in anger or frustration. So it has a corrective objective, whereas punishment is often administered, you know, for a harm or for a mistake made by a child in the past, and or for misdeeds, presumed misdeeds a child has done in the past. And it usually involves hostility, and there's frustration on the part of the parents. And what they create in children is that, like, when it's punishment, it's fear and guilt that you're creating. But when you discipline a child, there is a feeling of security within, you know, that you have with the child, a relationship of security, and you don't, you know, it doesn't and should not result in fear and guilt. That's how I see the differences between the two.
But most parents, most adults have the intention of disciplining a child. They have the intention of teaching the child a lesson of some sort. But where do you draw the line when you may want to teach the child something? How do you differentiate between what's abusive and what is disciplining?
It depends. Also, you know, it depends in the context, right? You know, if you come from a context like where I come from, where disciplining a child, you know, is a widely accepted behavior, maybe what you call their discipline and what you call here, like in a place like the U.S. where, you know, let's say physical beating of a child is not encouraged, then, you know, the definition or the line you draw would differ, you know. Where I come from, slapping a child is an accepted behavior, whereas, you know, depending where he goes, I might not be accepted. But it's about, you know, the intention and the harm it causes.
Okay, let's take slapping a child, for example. Is it abusive to slap a child if they do something wrong?
In my personal view, it is. But in a lot of cultural contexts, you know, so long as that does not cause severe harm to a child, many communities, especially, you know, traditional communities, accept that as, you know, as a way of disciplining a child. Does that have the effect of, you know, correcting the actions of a child? It's questionable. But the intention on the side of the parents within that context, it's not, you know, to harm the child. But it's the way people have been brought up like that. They've been, you know, they've been disciplined that way. So the only way that they know how to discipline their child is in that way.
What about whipping a child with a belt, for example? I'm trying to, what is the line? Where do you draw the line between, you know, disciplining a child and when does it become abuse? What about spanking a child with a hard hand or whipping with a belt?
I think, you know, I would go back to the definition of child abuse again. You know, you would need to unpack that because so long as it's an act that results in harm, it could be physical, it could be psychological, it could be emotional. Any act that results in that kind of harm should not be, you know, should not be accepted as a way of discipline. Or, you know, if it creates fear in the child, or if, you know, if it involves a threat of harm to the child, whether it's a belt, whether it's a slap, whatever you call it, I think any act that has the potential of resulting in this, I would say, you know, it's child abuse.
So you've been involved in investigating cases of child abuse in Ethiopia specifically. What are some of the kinds of things that you've seen in your professional experience?
Yeah, a lot of my work has been involved with women's rights and the rights of the girl. So a lot of the work that I've done in relation to children is usually, you know, in relation to the girl child. But generally, I mean, the abuses, you know, from physical abuse to emotional abuse to sexual abuse, it's quite common. But to go back to what I said earlier, because of the cultural context, you know, you wouldn't find cases. I'm a lawyer, so I look at the investigative side, you know, when cases are reported and what is done with the cases and so on. So I look at things that have been officially reported. For example, when we do research, that's where, you know, that's where we go. You wouldn't find cases where, you know, unless, for example, if it's a child abuse case involving physical abuse, it has to be severe to be reported because those cases are just not reported. Like I said, what society considers, you know, normal child disciplinary measures are quite wide, you know, the definition. So, but if it's a sexual abuse, it's likely, I mean, you know, over the years, the reporting has increased because of, you know, all the public campaign that has been done, all the public education that has been done. More and more child abuse cases are being reported. I would say that wouldn't tell you the real picture because I feel that to a large extent, a lot of these are underreported. But, you know, in the case of the context where I work in, where you don't have social services, where people don't have access to, you know, to the right institutions, to the institutions that are supposed to provide care and protection, then a lot of, you know, there is an issue of financial problems. So when you add all these issues, then it constrains people from moving forward with this case. So a lot of the time, I mean, I can give you specific examples. A lot of the time, if it's sexual abuse, it's discovered when the abuse results in a medical condition for the child. So a parent would take a child to a hospital and, you know, upon medical examination, the doctor will find out that a child has been sexually abused. whether it's a boy or a girl. And that's when, you know, that's when the doctor would call the parents in and he would say, you know, your child, there is a sign of sexual abuse. So your child, you know, has undergone through this. And so that's when the, you know, when children begin talking about that, because they, you know, usually they're abused. Research have shown, as in other parts of the world, they're abused by people they know. So people, you know, it could be a parent, it could be an extended family member, it could be a neighbor. So they are afraid to say anything about it. So they keep, the children keep quiet about it. And then, like I said, if there is a medical condition, that's when it comes out. But if it does not result in a medical condition, there are a lot of cases where children would not talk about it as well. So I would say cases are underreported.
So how would you detect, how does a person recognize that the child abuse may be going on? Say it's not so obvious, it's not a medical crisis where the child has to go to a hospital. How might another adult detect or recognize abuse is happening?
Well, I mean, I think behavioral change, you know, you can observe the behavior. For example, there are schools and teachers that report, say, you know, that suddenly find out, you know, children that have been active in class are quiet, or children that used to be social, very friendly to other students, you know, are not friendly anymore, start keeping to themselves or start being aggressive. It could be destructive behaviors that they exhibit. Or, you know, they might refuse to go home, or they might be reluctant to go home. Or their reaction to their abuser, you know, like children cannot control their reactions, right? So you have to observe their reaction. Let's say, you know, if a young girl is abused by her father, when her dad walks into the room, if you really observe, I think you can tell something is going on. Her reaction would change, or it could be her uncle, it could be anybody, it could be her teacher. So there are a lot of indications. But the sad thing is there isn't a lot of public awareness on these issues, like, you know, for parents or for teachers or for people around children to look out for these signs. So people might actually be not be aware of it. There is one case that I was involved in where a young girl, a six-year-old girl, was raped by her neighbor, a young boy. She never told anyone. You know, it's a big compound, and, you know, there are poor people, so there are 10 families living in the same compound. So when there is a public, there's a toilet that they all share. So when this girl goes to the toilet, obviously this guy has been raping her and has been threatening her that if she tells anyone, he'd kill her and he'd kill her mother, who's a single mother. So she never told her mother, but one morning there was a radio program that the organization I was working with, the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association, had this educational program on radio, and cases of child rape were being discussed. So there was a case of a young girl who was raped that was being discussed, and suddenly the six-year-old girl, the mother saw tears running down her face, and she said to her, "What do you understand about this, you know, for you to make you cry?" So she started questioning her. That's when she told her, "The same thing has been happening to me for the last how many months?" And she, you know, she immediately told her the story, who's been doing this, what has happened to her. And so she came and reported the case. So that, you know, that's another example that I, you know, a case that I know is the rape of a young boy, where he got sick, his mother took him to a hospital, and she was told that her son was sexually abused. And, you know, when they sat down with him and had a talk with him, he told them that the investigation head of a police department raped him. And so when the case became public, six other kids came forward and they said the same guy has been raping them in his office. Wow. I think his authority, you know, he'd threaten them because he's a police officer. He'd call them to his office on, you know, on any kinds of excuses. And then so they all had endured this and they all had kept quiet because they were afraid of him. But once this story came out, they all came forward. So there are, like I said, because you know, people are not aware of what the signs are, you know, how to look out for these signs. There are a lot of horrible things happening to kids that are not being reported.
Yeah, well, that's the whole purpose of our radio program, Taboo No More, is to discuss topics that people generally are hesitant to discuss. They don't want to discuss these things openly, so that people are aware of the signs. And so, as you said, to look for changes in behavior. If a child suddenly becomes changes in personality, become very quiet or destructive or aggressive, they show unusual change in behavior. If they show unusual reactions to people or situations, and you might want to probe into that and try to understand why the child is reacting differently or emotionally to different situations. So these are some of the signs to look for that there may be some form of abuse that may be going on that's not so obvious.
Yeah, but also, you know, like the prevention aspect of it is also very important. It's when, you know, when parents or caregivers know the risk that their children are exposed to, then they'd be able, you know, to make sure that some of these risks are avoided. For example, if you're living, you know, like I said, in the Ethiopian context, for a lot of people living in the same compound, it's common. So if there are, you know, young girls that you're leaving them behind and, you know, there are common toilets that they're sharing or there are, you know, young boys in the compound, then the risk of sexual abuse is higher. So if they are aware of that, then maybe they can do something about it. You know, they might not have, you know, wherever they go, they usually leave their kids because they have no opportunity, because they have to go work. But they can, you know, they can arrange for someone to look after them, or they can make sure that, you know, they take their children with them. There are a lot of things that can be done to prevent that. But like I said, public awareness is not there, so a lot of the things that could be prevented are not being prevented. The other problem is because these things are not talked about, people don't think, to a large extent, the public refuses to acknowledge that it's happening. It's like, you know, this is taboo in our culture, this is not happening, this is a Western phenomena, and so on. So for us who work in that context, we know it's happening. You know, I've seen cases of children as young as 1 year being sexually molested. There are a lot of cases, but because the public awareness side of things are not, you know, done as they should be done, or because there is lack of information and these issues are not discussed openly, people don't believe that these things happen.
Well, this may go a little bit more into the psychological rather than the legal aspect, but what causes people to abuse children? What, you know, what are some of the reasons somebody would do something abusive to a child?
You know, my thoughts or what they say when they are a lot. You know, a lot of the defenses that they use, like in cases that are common. Again, it's, you have to look at it within the context. It's like, because I was drunk, I was not aware of what I was doing, or, you know, evil spirits possessed me. And I am serious. These are the cases they use to argue in court. This is the defense they present, and every abuser has the same reason. But I mean, you know, they could be themselves victims of abuse. It could be because of other things that's going on in their life. You know, because of, it could be lack of money, it could be being out of job, it, you know, a lot of pressure. It could be that. But then at the end of the day, you question, why would that frustration, even in, they have that frustration, why would they take it out on a young child, especially their own child or somebody that, you know, that they know? So it has a psychological factor to it as well.
Right, right. Well, I'm going to open up the line in a few minutes just to remind our callers that the call-in number is 646-595-4721. And just dial the number 1 and you'll be placed in the queue with Denise. So feel free to call in when you want, if you have calls out there. So what should a person do, Emmabet, if they suspect that there may be child abuse going on? What action should a person take?
I think, you know, reporting it is one thing. I get, when it's reported, at least in a country like here, because you have social services, then, you know, the child can be removed from that abusive environment. But in context, you know, like in our context where such services are not available, And like I said, access to even to police stations is not as wide as it is elsewhere. It's hard. But I mean,
if you're a parent or a friend, would you say if there are not many services available, you should confront the person and
I don't think confronting is for the person because, you know, they might also become victims. Like for example, if a mother goes to, you know, to a person who has done this to her child and confronts him, what is there to protect her? So I would say in any context, removing the child from that environment should be the first thing, you know, before you proceed with anything else. But also, you know, one of the challenges that we encounter is people, again, are not aware. So a lot of education is needed. What do you do when a person is, for example, sexually abused? You know, you have to make sure that the medical exam takes place. You have to make sure that no evidence is tampered with and so on. So a lot of the time the problem is the, you know, the medical evidences are not there because they report the case days after it has happened, or even if it was immediately, you know, they wash them because they don't know that they're not supposed to do that before going to report the cases. So in our context, it's a lot more complex, I would say. So, you know, like it's not a one institution response. It's, you know, it cuts across a lot of institutions. But also it's a question of, again, there is the element of poverty also, you know, that creates a condition for these things to happen, or when these things happen, that prevents those who are supposed to provide care for the child from, you know, from providing that care. So I would say it's a lot complex in a
and
context like ours.
When abuse does occur, what can be done? I mean, obviously, it's reported and there's a medical evaluation, but the harm has been done to a child. What can be done for that child that's been a victim of abuse?
Well, counseling services are critical for anyone who goes on, you know, who faces this kind of abuse, right? So for child counseling is, you know, is critical, again, to ensure that they deal with the emotional and psychological harm that was done to them. So it's not just about reporting them and removing them from that environment, but how do you make sure that they function properly as children and later on as adults? So I think counseling plays a big role in the intervention.
So you would definitely, in all cases, recommend some form of therapy or counseling for...
Yeah, definitely. That is obvious.
I want to open up the line for callers. So the number is 646-595-4742. And we're talking with Emma Beth Kabede, who's currently at Harvard and a lawyer from Ethiopia who's done a lot of work in women's rights, women's issues, and child abuse. So I wanted to mention that in the U.S. there is a hotline available. Just want to provide this resource information available to people who may be listening. There's a Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline. You can look that up on the internet on Google. Just search Child Help Child Abuse Hotline, and there's a number 1-800-422-4453. For reporting child abuse, and I'm sure that you can call there and just ask for questions. But if you go to the website childhelp.org, they have a lot of resources available. So we are going to open the line. Denise, go ahead, and we'll take any callers. And I want to ask you a little bit about violence against women. What is the relationship between child abuse and violence against women? Do you often see those things go hand in hand?
Yeah, a lot of the times, yeah. I mean, you know, by definition, you know, allowing a child to witness the violence being committed against another person, especially a close member of the family, is also, you know, falls under the definition of child abuse, right? For a child to be living in that environment and to witness that because it has a psychological effect on them. But a lot of the times, you know, when their mothers are abused, you know, children tend to be abused as well. But at the same time, you know, the abuse results in, again, I'm talking about from the context that I know. So the abuse, you know, because of the abuse, it might result, the women, you know, the children might have to live with their parents. Usually it happens, you know, if women flee because of violence, they take their children with them. Again, we're talking in a context where there is only about two or three shelters in the whole country for abused women, right? So being financially dependent mostly on their husbands when they leave their, you know, their house for this reason, until they find legal remedy, they are, you know, without money, without shelter, so their children are exposed to a lot of things as a result of that. Again, not being in an environment that is, you know, conducive to their overall holistic growth, again, that it falls under, you know, under the definition of abuse of children. So definitely, especially in a context where, like I said, women are primarily caregivers for their children, but they're financially dependent on their husbands for their income, then, you know, when their mothers suffer, children tend to suffer. They, you know, they will not get education, they drop out from schools. Again, the environment they live in, as a result of that, you know, exposes them to a lot of abuse.
So when there is violence against a woman or a mother, the child is affected by being exposed to that violence, and then they may be affected in many other ways, such as not being able to go to school and not having a stable home environment, moving around, and so forth.
Exactly. But, you know, and then in cases where the mothers leave their children and live, then, you know, then children are not getting the best care that they should be getting because the fathers are out to work and there is no one taking care of the children. Again, in a context where, you know, poverty level is high, where, you know, your children might be exposed to any kind of harm, like I mentioned earlier, if it's a young boy or a young girl, depending on the context that you live in, then you might also expose them to abuse from the community or from people within the community that are capable of doing that. But at the same time, I mean, you know, again, in our context, to reflect on the positive side, as they say, you know, it takes a village to bring up a child in Africa. It is true. It takes a village. And a lot of people, you know, again, neighbors also extend care for the child. So there is also that positive side.
What about childcare support, childcare worker people, particularly in Ethiopia? Many families will have someone stay in the home to help with raising, taking care of the children. Do you see many cases of abuse in among childcare support help? That
they help abusing children?
Yeah.
Yes, there are. I mean, there are a lot of these cases being, you know, being talked about in terms of reporting, maybe not so much. But, I mean, you know, you hear, again, like I said, when it's severe, it gets reported. Yeah, there are, you know, caretakers do neglect the children. You know, there have been children that have been locked in the house the whole day because the caretaker, you know, just locked them up and went somewhere. There have been instances where, you know, if the child is cranky, that, you know, the caretakers have used drastic measures to, you know, to make them sleep. I've heard of cases where they've been given alcoholic drinks just to, you know, just to render them unconscious. So you hear about these extreme cases. But like I said, it's that very common. It's not backed by a data. So it's hard for me to make a conclusion on that. But there are instances of that.
Uh-huh. So it happens occasionally, but it's not a pattern.
Like I said, the pattern has not been studied, so it's hard to say.
Are there any particular risk factors of children for being abused? Age or culture, environment? What are some of the? I mean, you talked about poverty and being in a group environment where, you know, they may be going to a common toilet and exposed to people that are, you know.
Yeah. In schools, for example, one of the problems with public schools there is the facilities, the toilet facilities. In a lot of rural schools, you don't have, you know, separate boys and girls toilets, for example.
Right.
And a lot of mothers have been reluctant to send their girls to school because of, again, fear of abuse, or because abuse has resulted in that. If you look at distances children have to travel to get to schools, again, the girl child is exposed to a lot of, you know, abuse, abduction for marriage, rape by their teachers at the same time, you know, within school environment as well, by school guards. These are, like, common cases to find. In rape cases, you know, like, it is common to find school guards, including kindergarten guards, accused of, you know, raping or attempting to rape children. And a lot of it, surprisingly, happens in toilets when the kids go to the toilet. So education programs that, you know, that are being implemented in Ethiopia, if they're working on the girl's child, one of the primary things that they do is provide separate toilets.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the methods they use to, you know, like, for example, to decrease girls' dropout. Right?
Yeah.
That on its own wouldn't decrease it, but that's one of the causes, for example, the schools being friendly to young girls. That's what comes to mind right now, I think.
Uh-huh. You'd mentioned earlier that sometimes a child abuser was abused as a child himself. Do you see that pattern happening very often, where there's a kind of a cycle of a victim becoming a perpetrator of violence?
Sometimes, again, for this, you know, for this to come out, counseling both for the perpetrator and for the victim is important, right? So, you know, to be able to find out whether the abuser has been abused as a child, again, you know, unless he undergoes a certain level of counseling, it might not be something that you'd blurt out, right? So, again, working in a context where the services are limited, it's hard to say how much of that is true. But yes, there have been instances.
And what in Ethiopia specifically, what are the consequences of child abuse? If there's a report of child abuse and it's found to be an actual case of abuse, what are the consequences?
Well, I mean, you know, like this case, there have been improvements, like, because there have been a lot of non-governmental organizations working on child rights issues. For example, there are in most police stations, especially in the city context, there are police officers that are specifically allocated to follow up on the cases of abuse of on violence against women and violence against children. In a lot of the prosecutions, again, you know, they've been organized in a way so that at least one prosecutor from an office would be, you know, would focus on that. There are child courts that have been set up. I'm not saying that they're adequate or it works perfectly, but it's a huge improvement. So when cases are reported, the responsibility of the police officers is to pick out the cases that are, you know, reported related to abuse of children, women, and young offenders, the three of them. And there is so courtrooms have been also given the mandate to fast-track these cases. So there are specific courtrooms that these cases are sent to. There has been an attempt to do like a holistic approach, like, for example, when cases are reported, to make sure that the police, the prosecutor and police work together so that the police gathers the relevant data immediately, that you know, the abused child is sent to for medical examination immediately, whatever forensic exam work needs to be done is done immediately. So the idea is there, the system is being set up, and it's being tested again. Especially this fast-tracking process. So, normally once it reaches the police and the case is investigated, it goes to the prosecutor. Yeah, you know, the prosecution does prosecute on this case. And I have noticed and observed closely that there have been improvements on the type of sentences that are being passed. You know, in the past, while a rape of a child, according to our law, was maximum was punishable by 15 years, but the law has changed like 6-7 years ago, so now it can go up to 25 years. And you see cases where in the past, judges would, you know, the sentences they would pass would be 2 years or 3 years for, you know, for someone that could get 15 years. Now you see more severe sentences. Again, this is a result of public awareness, public education, and capacity building of, you know, law enforcement bodies, again, by non-government organizations working on these issues.
Is it more likely that convictions will be made?
Yeah, a lot of convictions. I mean, convictions are made. The issue was not only convictions, but the issue, one of the issues was, number one, yeah, obviously, for the conviction, again, it's a combination of factors, you know, is there a is there enough evidence to prove the unreasonable doubt that, you know, the accused is guilty, and for so many reasons that I mentioned earlier, like the capacity of the police. For example, there isn't a rape kit in police stations, you know, so they don't do the proper investigation. The way they request for medical information from, you know, from medical institutions is that has a problem of its own, because the police does not know how to gather evidence, what to look for such kinds of cases. So usually there is a weak evidence gathering. I mean, normally it's rape cases are hard to prove, especially for adults. For children, it might be a little easier. But it's because of these factors, when the case gets to court, it goes with, you know, with weak evidence. So there were a lot of acquittals. But even in cases where strong evidence was presented, the judges would mitigate sentences, you know. They'd convict, you know, the accused. He'd be convicted, but instead of giving him, you know, 15, 12, 13 years, they would give him 2 years. And they would use all kinds of reason, because he would say, you know, like, I have a family that I have to take care of, you know, so many people are dependent on me, this is my first crime, you know, all kinds of excuses that you can present to mitigate a penalty. And so, as a result, they would get off easily. But now, because more and more attention is being given to the issues, there is a marked difference. All of us who work in this area have seen a marked difference, an improvement, but it's not good enough. You know, like, it's in the right track, but none of us are satisfied. There's a lot more that needs to be done.
Okay, well, I'm speaking with Amabet Kabede, who is a lawyer in Ethiopia, studying at Harvard University right now. We're talking about child abuse and violence against women. If you would like to call in, you need to dial 646-595-4742, and you need to press 1. There are a couple of callers on the line, but you have to press 1 to ask a question, and then Denise will handle your call. I think we can go ahead and take the first call.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry. I don't know if you guys already touched on this. I joined a little early, late. But my question is, typically, the problem in the Ethiopian community tend to be most parents are authoritarian than authoritarian, and they have very strict rule, and they use punishment, physical punishment, to discipline their kids without really explaining the reason behind it or the reason behind their rules. What kind of advice would you give parents, especially here in America? Parents want to discipline their kids the way they were disciplined in Ethiopia. What kind of, you know, discipline methods can they use?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, Amabet. So you had spoken earlier about how in Ethiopia punishment is a fairly, you know, common way of disciplining children. But so our caller is asking, what are some other alternatives to a more severe punishment to help discipline children more effectively?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether I should be talking to the U.S. context, because this really is not my context, but I think it's, you know, again, it's a question. It's an awareness thing, isn't it? Parents think that by doing what they're doing, they're actually disciplining their children. I think when they punish their children, their objective is, you know, to correct, you know, future acts, right? It's not, I don't think they're doing it, you know, to terrorize their child or to create...
they don't mean to terrorize the child.
Exactly.
They're really,
yeah. Mostly, I think,
right.
Most parents do that. The intention is good, but the delivery is a problem. And a lot of it, I think, in our context for Ethiopian parents, because culturally it has been done that way, you know. They have been disciplined that way, so they think that that's the best way to discipline their children. I think it's a lot of discussion is needed within the community on this issue, and a lot of, you know, awareness creation is needed. Because if parents knew that what they're doing is damaging to their children, I think if they're convinced of that, they would refrain from doing it. That's
so
my belief.
Go ahead, caller.
I think one thing I noticed is that even though they obviously don't know they are, affecting the abuse, punishment is impact somehow is going to impact the child. Most parents, at least from my experience, they do it out of anger. And when you do something out of anger, it doesn't really communicate to whether children or old adults that what is done is wrong. It needs to be done another way or communicate effectively. I see a lot of parents punishing their kids for something they did, but they are enraged. They're not even thinking about, you know, what they're doing. And we have heard stories, whether in Ethiopia or here, Ethiopian parents abusing their children to the point that the kids are becoming disabled as a result of the punishment. Yeah. And I think one thing, at least I have heard, and, you know that works, is that, you know, parents who explain the consequences to the kids. If you come late, if you do this, if you don't clean your room, this is what's going to happen. Explaining to the kids, I think I have seen it work. And also, you know, and following through that. If kids are not doing what they were supposed to do, parents doing what they say they're going to do to punish them, whether it's not allowing them to watch TV or hang out with their friends or buying them something they wanted, following through, I think, is what I have seen work, at least here.
It's a matter of setting what the consequence will be for that behavior, but then following through it consistently, following through, making sure if you say you're going to take the TV away or you're going to put a child, you know, discipline them, put them in their room or suspend them, to follow through with it and make sure that you're consistent with it.
And if I may add something, also parents to be in the same page. Mom and dad need to be in the same page. It's a punishment. They want to talk about it. They don't want to do it in front of the kids. And talking about it and having, the same punishment, you know, to use the same punishment and to be on the same board, because kids can use that and they can see it if parents are not on the same page.
Yeah, and it's very common for parents not to be on the same page, to have a different view of what's acceptable or not acceptable. But so it's important for parents to talk about those things and try to reach an agreement about how they want to discipline the kids together.
Yeah, but also I think in our culture, you know, both back home, I mean, at least there, because services are limited, the choice is not here. But counseling, you know, like whether it's marriage counseling or family counseling, is not accepted in our community. Like, I mean, they see it as a weakness in their parenting, maybe. I don't know. But I think, you know, there isn't that culture of going to a third party, you know, to an expert on these issues, to discuss the problems openly and, you know, to ask for help. I don't think it's common in our society, and I think it's sad in a country where those services are available, people are not taking advantage of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in this country, there are many, many services available for counseling, even specifically, you know, Ethiopian community. There are counseling centers in Northern Virginia and D.C. That specialize in working with Ethiopian families. So yes. I think, you know, we do want to educate our listeners about that those resources are available, and if people are having problems with some of these issues, there are places you can go, and it's not a sign of weakness to get help and talk about some of these problems.
To add one point on this, again, something that I encounter a lot in my work, for example, talking about something, a problem in your family is publicly is such a taboo, to the extent that, you know, even when you're having problems with your kids, or even when your kids are being abused, there are a lot of cases that I've encountered where fathers have molested their children, their girls, sexually, and the mothers would not take the cases to court. And eventually, when the case reaches, you know, the police for some reason, when they're asked why they haven't reported, they're like, you know, no, it's like us exposing our belly to the public, blah, blah, you know, like the kind of... because it's such a taboo to talk about these things, you know, and it's seen as exposing your dirty laundry in public,
right.
A lot of abuses remain unreported, and a lot of abuses don't find solutions. And I think it's also the same in terms of punishment and disciplining. A lot of parents punish instead of disciplining their children, but, you know, they don't know how to do better, or they don't know how to discipline. And if you don't talk about your problems, you're not going to find solutions for them.
Yeah, I think a lot of times, you know, a first step is to talk with a friend or talk with a teacher in the school. It's important if you may be afraid to reach out to, you know, the official authorities, but if you start by talking to a teacher or a nurse or even, you know, a religious practitioner, it's just to begin the conversation, to talk to somebody if you have concerns or if you have fears or you're worried that your child or someone you know is suffering from some form of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, Ethiopian parents or non-Ethiopian parents have to know child abuse is against the law, and there are consequences. There are people being deported, people being sentenced. There is a consequences. You know, if nothing is going to stop people from doing it, knowing that it's against the law, and there is severe consequences might happen. And I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, Amabet, you want to comment on that?
The deterrent effect of the law, definitely. But, I mean, it will deter, but would that bring about change of behavior in the long run? That is important, I think, you know, especially in a country like the U.S. where these laws are implemented, then, yeah, it can have a deterring effect. But ultimately, at the end of the day, they also have to understand that what they are doing is wrong and that it can be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can be better parents. And
Right. Ultimately,
I think for the children, it's important to have their parents with them, but who are, you know, more informed parents who can, you know, who understand their children and, you know, who discipline them in the right way as opposed to punishing them. So ultimately, you would want a change of attitude. You'd want a change of behavior.
I would even say, you know, there are many parents or people who may be abusive to children who don't want to be. They don't even recognize that they're, you know, they may have grown up in a culture where, you know, beating a child is seen as normal discipline. And then they realize that's not the best thing for their child and they want to stop. But it's difficult. It's difficult to discipline children. You know, as a parent myself, I know how difficult it can be at times, and you do get angry. It's natural. You become angry when a child is not behaving and they're doing things that you don't want them to do. So it's hard to be an effective disciplinarian, a good parent in that way. And there are resources around. the communities here in the U.S. where there are courses on parenting and discipline, parent education courses in community colleges and schools and community centers, which can be very helpful. So it's important to even recognize when, you know, you see it in yourself and you want to improve your discipline techniques. We do have, I think, another caller or two that's on the line, but you have to dial the number 646-595-4742, and you have to press 1 or dial 1 to get in queue for asking a question. So we have a few more minutes to continue this conversation, and we're here talking with Amabet Kabede, who's studying at Harvard University right now on a fellowship at Harvard. So is the caller on the line? Do you have any other questions? Okay, let's proceed. So we have a few more minutes if somebody wants to call in. We've talked about when you see changes in behavior in a child, when you see a child reacting emotionally, that you think something may be going on. Let me ask you this, Amabet. How do you approach a child when you are concerned? If you see these changes in behavior, if you see these reactions, how do you approach a child? Assume the child is fearful, they don't really want to talk about this. How can you go about, you know, getting them to talk or getting their information?
I think there has to be some form of trusted relationship. Like if it's a teacher, for example, for girls, usually, you know, they find it easier to talk to their female teachers. Or it could be, I mean, if it's a member of the family, again, it has to be somebody that the children trust. And you also need to, you know, be able to communicate with them in a way that what they are telling you is not a betrayal of, you know, of their loved ones. If they're abused by someone that they trust, then them talking about it to you, it's not, you know, it's not a betrayal by them. But usually, once it is suspected that children are undergoing abuse, then the best way is, you know, for a professional counselor. There are social counselors that are, you know, experts at this. So usually they open up, they have a way of talking to them, and they open up to them, which is why, as I mentioned earlier, now the courts in Ethiopia have started training social counselors for this specific purpose, because, and the police stations do have counselors in places where there is a unit for abused children. They do have counselors sitting there when kids come to report in, or when parents come with their children, they talk to them in private and with the parents, and, you know, they make them comfortable enough for them to be able to tell the story. So I think it needs sensitive handling, but it has to be someone with whom they have, you know, a trust, someone in whom they have trust, or someone with whom they can feel free and open up to talk about.
I mean, I assume you don't just come right out and say, are you being abused? Is somebody...
No.
So how can you kind of bring up the subject in a way that might make a child feel comfortable to talk about it?
Yeah. It's also, you know, with children also, there is a feeling of guilt, right? When they're abused, uh-huh. They feel that they brought it upon themselves. So how do you get them to open up about that? It's not about jumping in, but usually, I mean, you know, it is related. You notice it because their behavior has changed, right? That's why you watch them to see if something is wrong. So there are ways of going about it to find out without necessarily asking them, you know, are they being abused or whatever. You can focus on the changes that you have noticed. If they're reluctant to go home, you know, you can sensitively find out why they don't want to go home. Yeah.
I noticed that you don't feel like going home today, or you're quiet today, or you're acting, you know, different. Is something bothering you?
Yeah.
Yeah. How are you feeling? Is there somebody or something that's bothering you?
Yeah.
Kind of approach it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a counselor and I'm not really an expert on that, but, you know.
Okay.
That is what,
well,
I would say.
We have time for, I think, one more caller. We have one more caller on the line. So please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes. Go
okay.
ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. This is Rivka. I appreciate for this opportunity about women and kids and, you know, how we can react to this kind of situation in Ethiopian culture, because it's very hard to diagnose this kind of situations, because, you know, it's culturally we're not to telling to people what our parents say, or if they are abusing us, or if somebody's abusing you. So it's very hard to diagnose this kind of situation, but I'm so glad that this kind of opportunities come out for Ethiopian kids to come out and say, you know, I'm abused, you know, that way they can have, they can get some help, you know.
So, yeah, it's important to let children know that it's okay to talk about these things, that, you know, if somebody's hurting you, it's important to tell people about it.
Yes, and my question for Mrs. Emebet,
yeah.
Yes, and like how if the child came and talked to you about the situation, how can you communicate this with the parents? Because they could be defensive. It's because of our culture, you know, the family could be very defensive, and even they'll be very angry about the situation. So how can you communicate with the parents?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So if the child brings up the question, or there's a suspected abuse, Emebet, how do you approach the parents?
I mean, you know, I think in our culture, the best way it would work is a social mechanism. You know, it's somebody, again, you know, in our culture, you don't go to the police, or you don't go to court. I mean, depending on what the case is, if it's an issue of, you know, a child coming and complaining, you know, that they're being punished and everything. And I think if there is harm, I would say always report. But at the same time, I think the discussion, you know, it could be a neighbor that the parent listen to. It could be a community leader. It could be a religious leader. It could be, you know, we have what we call Nafsabat, for example, in Ethiopia, where a lot of families are, you know, respectful to this, are just pressed that, you know, that work with the families, or that are supposedly the spiritual mentors of the families. There are different ways of doing it in a traditional community. It's about for me, ultimately, I think as a community, unless as a community these acts are rejected, it will be hard to make a difference. So for me, I would say, even for, you know, for neighbors or for other family members, to be able to go to the parents and say, you know, this is not the right way of disciplining your child, or this is not an accepted behavior, you should not let this slide by, and so on. There needs to be some level of awareness on the side of the community that these acts are wrong. No, they're not wrong just because they're legally wrong. There's a reason why they are not acceptable legally, you know, ultimately, because it's because it harms the child.
Right.
That's why there is law. It's to protect the children. You know, they're not there for the sake of just, you know, enforcement. There is a reason why the law recognized it as an abuse. And ultimately, it's a question of, I think, everyone understanding that these acts are harmful to the children.
Yes,
and
well, I think, as parents,
I've seen it happen in the case of, you know, female genital mutilation, and in other forms of abuse, that like deeply entrenched cultures, where when parents realize the harm that actually causes this to their children, they tend to refrain from those acts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was an excellent question, and it's a very good way for us to end the program tonight. I want to thank you so much, Emmabet Kabede, for being our special guest tonight. I think the bottom line of this program is don't ignore these things. You have to talk about these things. You have to let people know if something is going on, something is wrong. You have to bring it to the surface. And if there is real harm, there's real abuse, that needs to be reported. I mentioned earlier there's a website called childhelp.org if people want more information about child abuse. And this program has been a production of One World Communications in collaboration with People to People. Next Thursday night, the People to People program will continue. So thank you to our guests tonight. Thank you for our callers. And thank you for listening. We look forward to talking to you again on Taboo No More next month. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks.
Okay. No, we have to charge it.